Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start things off with the Globe's Joan Vinaki and WGBH's David Bernstein talking politics. From Scott Brown's investment in Florida to a Democratic convention in Worcester to a $1 billion sweetheart deal in South Boston. Then we'll talk to you about the lottery. To some, it's Robin Hood in reverse. To others, the pot of gold for cities and towns. But is it a bad bet for Massachusetts?
We're all revved up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price on juvenile murders, getting parole, and transgender rights. Are we crossing the next frontier? Then we'll ask you, for a $75 break, are you willing to be crammed into a hotel room no bigger than your walk-in closet? WGBH's arts editor Jared Bowen on last night's Tony Awards and his reviews of the newest shows and movies around town. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Hello, Jim.
Welcome back, Marjorie.
We have a little announcement.
We do.
Yes, we do.
But Friday was actually National Donut Day. Is that what you're talking
National Donut Day.
I missed it, too.
No, in September, we're going to add an extra hour. Instead of being noon to 2, we're going to be 11 to 2.
That is correct.
I'm in a panic already.
Mid-September, Boston Public Radio will extend an hour. And we should also thank listeners, because that's why it happened. You're aware of that, correct?
I am aware of that, Jim.
Well, thank you all, and we're looking forward to it in mid-September. So let's get started. Bad judgment, naive, dolt, craven dolt. That's the word cloud hovering over former and aspiring Senator Scott Brown. As you know, he's been getting slammed by just about everyone for his role as senior advisor to some obscure Florida-based penny stock company. Apparently, he's buckled under the bad press, resigned from the firm. He also says he'll give back the $1.3 million worth of stock he'd received. But as of last week, the stock had already plummeted to $455,000 worth. So has his stock as a candidate also plummeted? Joining us to go over these and other political headlines are WGBH political analyst David Bernstein. David's also a contributing editor of Boston Magazine. Hey there, David.
How are you doing?
And Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinaki. Hello, Joan. Almost got your name wrong. That was humiliating,
thanks,
wasn't
Jim.
It? Nice to see you, Joan.
We're really happy to hear about that extra hour. That's right.
That's an extra hour to make mistakes like that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's correct. So I want to give Craven Dull, I want to give credit to my colleague at the Boston Herald, Peter Gilson, as he called Scott Brown a Craven Dull. So
he's got nothing on Shirley Lee Hung in the Boston Globe, by the way.
No, she said he had no common sense and lousy judgment and is working for this, you know, penny stock, and questioned whether or not Scott Brown had seen the movie Wall Street, because, of course, the Wolf of Wall Street, I should say the Wolf of Wall Street, not Wall Street, the Wolf of Wall Street, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, was all about these penny stocks and being terrible. But in any case, Joan Vinaki, what do you think? Is this going to stick for the Scott Brown, of course, is running for Senate in New Hampshire. Is this a stick, or do people not care about this?
Well, Scott Brown definitely does not have the vote of the Boston punditry.
That is correct.
But you never want to count the guy out. I wrote many a time when he was running against Martha Coakley that there was no way he could win. So who knows what New Hampshire is going to do? This seems like it's damaging. It really does. But there are other things in play. Obama's favorability in New Hampshire is plummeting. It's going down. Jean Shaheen has some things going for her, but not everything.
How about you, David? What's your sense of the staying power of this thing?
I agree with Joan. This is damaging. It feeds into, this perception that he's not really a serious person, and he's not really serious about politics, that he sort of got out of politics, started looking for ways to make a buck, took the Fox News job, grabbed, someone offered to put him on a board. He said, sure, whatever. And then suddenly he said, oh, maybe I'll be a senator again. So it takes away the seriousness. But all that said, come November, this race is very likely to be about, just sort of whether New Hampshire is trending way back to the Republican side again, as it has, as it did in 2010, or if it's not making that big swing. So I don't know that this, I think it's big, it's very damaging. It makes it fun to write about him again.
It's better that it happened now than October, right?
Yeah.
But it seems to me, I'm going to argue both sides of this. The bad news for him is it seems to me it makes a nice television ad later in the campaign, even though it will be forgotten. I think the other mistake he made is silence. My sense is you should have held a press conference, said, I'll take all your questions about this. there's no there there. I mean, whether there is there there or not. And say, by the way, I'm done talking about this thing. This is not what people care about in New Hampshire. They care about jobs. They care about Obamacare. End of discussion. But the flip side is, you know, look at, I'm not equating these things at all. The Charlie Baker thing, which we were all in a frenzy about a couple of weeks ago, about him giving $10,000 to the senatorial, whatever, the state committee in New Jersey, controlled by Chris Christie. Coincidentally, shortly thereafter, Chris Christie's state invests in a fund that is, what, the parent fund of Charlie Baker's, one of the operations he's involved in. Do you know any real person who is talking about that for more than like 30 seconds? The Charlie Baker thing. It's a similar sort of complexity, I think, for
I
people.
I thought the same thing, the Baker situation, in which I thought the same thing that you just said about Scott Brown. I thought Charlie Baker should have a big press conference, say, bring it on, answer mm-hmm. every question that was thrown at him. You know what? He didn't. And as you just pointed out, in the latest polling, it does not seem like the people are all that worried about Baker and Chris Christie. So I guess these candidates know something. What they know is that junkies follow this stuff in minute detail, but the world at large is thinking that it's finally summer.
But I think you had a good point, David Bernstein, about this playing into the Scott Brown narrative. I don't like that story about Charlie Baker, except that he was, you know, a venture capitalist kind of guy, an investment kind of guy. That doesn't hurt.
That's a very good point.
Charlie
That's a good
Baker.
Point.
This does.
I mean, because it's not how people see Charlie Baker.
Well, if you
Baker.
Have questions about the gravitas of Scott Brown, which some right. people do, although I'm not sure that those people are going to be turned away. Gravitas or not gravitas, but it does play into that narrative.
Well, it does. And there's also a sort of bigger thing here. You know, I was thinking about the Baker thing also, that it's very, very tough to go out of politics into business, and particularly the business of becoming wealthy by being around wealthy people, which is sort of what, you know, what this is really about. You know, the wealthy people make money differently than the rest of us. And when you do that, when you go into that world and then you come back into the politics world, you think that it's a separate thing. It doesn't have anything to do with it. But it just looks, it's very tough for ordinary people. You know, it's very tough for ordinary people to look at this stuff coming out about Baker and think, wait a minute, he made a whole ton of money by not really working for anybody, but sort of lending his name, and they call him a partner, but he's not really a partner, you know. And you've have this stuff with Scott Brown, you know. Again, this is not that unusual in the world where, yeah, put me on a board, you get to use my name, and in return, I'll get a bunch of your stock, which might be worth something someday, you know. And this stuff to ordinary people just looks bad, and I think it accumulates over time. You know, they're going to be attacking Charlie Baker as healthcare executive who took a lot of money for himself while he was denying benefits for people. That's how they're going to portray him, the Democrats will, and this will feed into a little bit. It does with Scott Brown, and frankly, Warren Tolman is going to have the same problem, and anyone else who tries to come back from
he's running
world.
For attorney general on the Democratic
side. I think
for
it's a big, you know, it's a bigger problem for Scott Brown, though, because of one thing that I just make the point of Scott Brown's, you know, sort of image was kind of everyman.
Right.
That's
right.
A good point,
and,
too.
And yeah. Nobody thinks of Charlie Baker as everyman. They think of him as a former healthcare executive. And if he's done something, if he's a partner or not a partner, it's mysterious, but it's not a big disconnect. He does not look like everyman here. He looks like every politician trying to get rich, and it's not a good story for him.
Okay, so let's move on. We're talking to David Bernstein from GBH and Boston Magazine, and Joan Vinaki, I got it right that time, from the Boston Globe. Okay, here's a quiz for either Joan or David to answer. What do three of the four of us in the studio have in common? Either of you want to answer that question? I'll answer it. You want to answer it, Marjorie?
I have no idea.
David, Joan, and I are going to the Democratic Convention. Worcester. Marjorie is the smart one. She is not. I am correct. Is that right? Of course it is.
I hadn't been planning on
Saturday
it.
Saturday in Worcester, yes.
Saturday.
I called into service, but
beautiful
I hope
downtown.
Not.
Okay, so David, you quoted in a piece, I think it was in Boston Magazine, what you admit is sort of a back of the envelope sort of polling data on the issue. The conventional wisdom goes like this. Steve Grossman has the sort of party people, mm-hmm. and he is hoping to knock off the woman who is crushing him in the polls at the convention, Martha Coakley. If Coakley beats him at the convention, is that the end of Grossman? If she doesn't win the activists, is he going to say the core of the party is? What is the poll show, and what's your sense of what Saturday is going to show, and what will it mean?
Yeah, the poll that you're talking about was a survey done by another candidate for a different statewide office, surveying the delegates. So it's not a scientific poll; it was just robocalling delegates. But it did show Steve Grossman with the support of about 34%, and then Don Berwick and Martha Coakley trailing at about 20% each. And then Julia Kayyem at about 9%, Joe Avalon at 7%. So both of them would be below where they need to be for 15% to make the primary ballot in September. And then only about 10 or 11% undecided. Again, not necessarily a scientific poll, but it was a poll of a good chunk of the delegates. So, and that rings fairly true for what people think is about where things are. I think a lot of the votes are still very pliable, in terms of, from where people I talk to, there are a lot of people who say I'm with so and so, but that could still change. So, I think that Grossman has to do very well because he's got to have something that changes the narrative, gets people, both the Democrats in the state, but also the media and everybody, to sort of think that there's a possibility that the Martha Coakley train could derail, and that he could have a chance. Coakley obviously wants to keep that, keep her loss to a minimum, I guess, and just be able to shrug it off as, well, I didn't get quite as many insiders as he did, so what's the big deal? And then for the rest of them, it's, can they make the ballot? I think Steve Grossman, and Joan can talk about this dynamic, but I think that Steve Grossman would very much like to have all the rest of them wiped off so he can have sort of a one-on-one shot against the front runner, where Coakley might prefer to have some others make the ballot with
him. Is that your take, since you're going to be in Worcester too?
Well, I think part of the conventional wisdom is that Steve Grossman wants a two-person race, him against Martha Coakley. But I think
the conventional wisdom 3 months ago was he wanted Kayyem and Coakley to split the so-called women's vote. What happened to that?
The conventional wisdom is allowed to change.
So go ahead, a head-to-head race.
I think that it is a double-edged sword to draw out a political cliche for Grossman. So he wins a convention, and if I were Coakley, I'd then say, great, he's the candidate of the insiders.
Exactly.
It gives her, who is really a candidate of the establishment and the status quo, an opportunity to say, I'm the outsider, I'm the upstart, I'm the Deval Patrick of 2014.
It's
tough.
But does it matter? Does anybody? I mean, I know there'll be headlines in the papers the next day, and it will lead the evening news. But, and obviously, if Grossman ends up pulling this out, he's going to do ads off this, that he wins the convention. Does that have any, use the expression I used before, does anybody care? Does that have any staying power with real people? What happens in Worcester? Let's start with you, Joan Vernocchi, or no?
I have to speak for real people.
Yes, you may.
I think real people are not part of Worcester's equation. This is about keeping hope alive.
Okay.
Yeah. But you know what was interesting? I forget if it was a Globe story or Herald story. Maybe it was your story, Bernstein. But somebody was, David Bernstein, somebody was mentioning that Martha Coakley, yet again, is not out at all the chicken dinner circuits, and she's not out at the Dorchester Day Parade, and Baker's at the Dorchester Day Parade, and Steve Grossman's at the Dorchester Day Parade. In other words, she's not campaigning her heart out here. And that was one of the criticisms when she lost to Scott Brown.
I don't know about that, but I do say that, and I'm not an expert on polling, but the polling data from the Globe and I think also
from the
Herald shows a much narrower race than people might have thought between Martha Coakley and Charlie Baker. And there is
single digits in both polls.
And there is sort of a opportunity for a repeat of what played out, I hate to say, with Coakley against Scott Brown, where she led by huge amounts and then things started imploding. And I think you could see some of that possible writing on the wall here.
Yeah, I definitely think that there is a nervousness within the Democratic Party, and just not necessarily just the Democratic Party establishment, but ordinary Democrats who will be choosing in September who to vote for in a primary, of, are we going to lose again with Coakley at the top of the ticket? And I think that there could be a sort of signal taken out of this convention of, if Martha Coakley gets 25%, let's say, of the first ballot, that sort of could be taken as, geez, 3/4 of the people who know her best are saying we don't want her to be our nominee. That could have some resonating effect. But on the other hand, she leads everybody in all the polls. She has huge favorability ratings. And by the way, I do think she's out there campaigning. It's easy to sort of draw. Because people have that in their head, they're looking at for it. So, okay, she wasn't at the Dorchester Day Parade.
But
she was
away
out in Western Massachusetts that day doing stuff out there. But, You know, and also she doesn't have quite the campaign. You know, Steve Grossman is just a campaign machine.
Right. If it doesn't happen in Boston, the media tend not to pay attention to it.
What about Charlie Baker? The whole storyline. It's not the rap. It's the storyline that Charlie Baker in 2014 is a different candidate. Is he a different candidate, Joan Vernocchi?
I don't see all that much difference. I mean, I see the trappings of difference. He tweets pictures of himself.
Yeah.
He did the ad with his brother who's gay.
Which I thought was great, by the way. Yeah, I mean, it was terrific.
I mean, he's trying, you know, to send out the signals that he's a human being.
Despite conventional wisdom, as you would say, Joan.
But the test will be when he's one-on-one, when you're asking him questions, when he's in a debate, can he get that chip off his shoulder a little bit? Can he come across, I think, as more human and open and accessible?
The Boston Herald's having a debate tomorrow, I should say, for all the Democrats. It's going to be 11 o'clock. You can stream it live at bostonherald.com, and you'll be able to see it again at the website. That should be kind of fun to see how they, because all five of them are showing up.
But you know, the whole dynamic, what Joan was just describing, come the fall, assuming it is a Coakley, and you know, who knows? That's obviously where it is right now. And Baker, you were always talking about Jeff McCormick, who spent a lot of time us in the studio. And by the way, Coakley and Grossman will both be with us in studio this week. Grossman tomorrow, and Martha Coakley on Wednesday. We should have said we'll be on the radio with us. If you have questions, you can email them to us as well. No one can quite figure out how Jeff McCormick plays in this. And by the way, there are three independents. Evan Falchuk is the second. I think the guy Lively, I don't know his first name, is the third. Do you know his first name?
Scott Lively.
Thank you very much.
Very
I knew
good.
You would. They're not doing quite as well, at least in the Globe poll, as McCormick. Where does McCormick take away from? I mean, who does he hurt?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom is that he will hurt Charlie Baker. That Charlie Baker has there's a limit on how many votes are available to a Charlie Baker, to any Republican in the state. Jeff McCormick is very similar to Baker in a lot of ways in his background, former Republican, and he's solid. You know, I mean, he comes across as a smart, competent, capable guy. So people who are sort of voting against the Democratic Beacon Hill machine who end up with McCormick presumably are taking away from Baker a little bit more than anything else. But what I'll tell you is, you look back at 4 years ago, and what happened with Tim Cahill as running as the independent is not so much that in the end he was the force to be reckoned with or the reason that Baker lost. It was that the idea of Tim Cahill got in the Baker campaign's head from early on, and they focused their whole campaign around being terrified of Tim Cahill stealing votes. And there's some evidence that they are again getting sucked into that trap with Jeff McCormick, and that Jeff McCormick could throw them off their game in ways, you know, that more than really should, because in the end, I don't think he's likely to have that much of an effect on the outcome.
Can I quote one of my favorite pundits on this phrase? That'd be me. I think and we've had this discussion with Baker. We've had this discussion with Shannon O'Brien, who was the victim of this particular strategy. The strategy for Baker come the fall, assuming he's the nominee, is to me easy, is the gang of three. It's the Mitt Romney argument all over again from 2002. Right. The House is going to be overwhelmingly Democratic. The Senate's going to be overwhelmingly Democratic. Do you want any check on this at all? And if you're sort of even if you're leaning a little bit towards the Democrat or the independent, you say, well, you're right, we do want a check. And I think he's got even a stronger argument. Charlie, when he used to be a regular guest with us prior to his announcing, we asked him one day, I don't know if Marjorie and I did, aren't you better off if the whole Republican Party goes up in flames except for you in the fall? And to his credit, instead of giving the stupid answers saying, no, we want a strong, he said, I'd have to think about that. And my analysis is this, is if you take away Richard Tesei, who's running against John Tierney, assuming Tierney wins his primary, then essentially there's no other Republican anyone's even heard of. And if Charlie Baker says, don't you want one of us balancing the Democratic absolute control in this state, not to mention just Beacon Hill? That's a powerful strategy, Joan.
Well, you started off asking about Jeff McCormick. Saying if I were Jeff McCormick, what I would be saying to you is, yeah, the gang of three do we want the gang of three? No, we don't. But I'd also be saying the Republican brand in Massachusetts is poison Do you want somebody who even in any way has an R next to their name that puts them in some way in debt to some agenda that we in Massachusetts do not agree with?
You mean like the Tea Party slash Washington agenda?
Right. Yeah. I'm just saying that that's – and also, I mean, again, I mean, McCormick is – I don't think independents really can win here. Even though 50% of the voters are unenrolled and claim to be independents, it's still a two-party mentality. But if you're McCormick, you're just saying, look, on paper, there's an opening for me. There is this group, this block of voters who call themselves unenrolled. They're tired of Democrats, particularly after 8 years mm-hmm. of one-party rule, and they don't like Republicans very much. So here I am.
Yeah. And you know, what you're saying about that there are no other Republicans who anybody's heard of and that, you know, they basically are a non-entity in the state. Well, so what's the difference between having that third part of the triumvirate be a Republican versus an independent? There's no, you know, what's the difference? What's the advantage of having a Republican in that role? He's basically an independent.
Well,
right?
The only argument I'd make, I think that's a decent one, is what Joan just said, is that we all are still, that we have demonstrated, we are still in this state in a two-party mindset, even though the Republican Party has virtually no support in the state as a party.
And I agree. I'm just saying that would be McCormick's argument.
Yeah, I understand that. You
know. We're talking to David Bernstein, contributing editor to Boston Magazine and WGBH's political analyst, and Joan Vernachie, a columnist for the Boston Globe. There is one thing that McCormick has that Tim Kaine did not, and that's lots and lots of money. So he can run a lot of ads. He's a nice-looking man, as you say. He's a solid guy, comes across very well. Couldn't that be a factor if this guy is on television massively for weeks right before the election?
I know. I've said this before with other candidates, but if I were his wife, I'd take away his debit card.
Well, you know, I mean,
it's money poorly spent.
Well, he might have enough millions that he can, you know, afford to spend a couple of million on advertisements. I mean, that's a big deal, is it not?
Yeah,
yes,
sure. That's
is.
Why. That's why we have Senator Pagliuca in Washington.
I mean, Tim Kaine had no money.
Let's see.
And Tim Kaine has
done
better.
Carrie Healey spent, I think, $10 million of her own money. That helped a lot.
Yeah. I think he's saying we forget about it, Marjorie.
Pagliuca spent like a gazillion dollars.
Did he come in last or second last?
I think he might have gotten double digits in that primary.
But Celtics won the world championship a couple of years later. So.
No, I mean, part of the question is how much of his money is he going to spend? It's not entirely clear. Is it going to be more like $1 million, which is, or is he going to spend $10 million, which is a real amount of money? The other thing is, you forget Tim Kaine came in with huge name recognition and popularity. You know, in the early going, he was polling at, 30%.
Right.
He had a lot of money. He had raised a ton of money. So he had, he didn't raise much money afterwards, but he came in with a few million dollars piled up. So, it wasn't the money that was the problem for him. It was the sort of two-party thinking.
And Kaine did better than any other independent.
Yeah.
What do you get? Eight points, I
think? I think
you got eight, seven,
seven
or eight.
Points, eight
okay.
points. Okay.
So you started, you said if it's $1 million or if it's $10 million, what if it's $100 million? And here's the $100 million I want to talk about briefly. Casey Ross wrote a piece in the Globe following a column by Jeff Jacoby quoting Greg Sullivan, who was the former inspector general of state, former Democratic state rep, talking about this $1 billion bond bill. I don't want to give people a headache, but I am over the edge on this thing. We have a probation trial going on that absolutely nobody is paying attention to. Nobody.
I am.
Well, maybe 12 people are paying attention in addition to the defendants, which I think exposes the worst of Beacon Hill and then some. And then you have this story by Casey Ross, and anybody correct me if I'm wrong. There's $1 billion bond bill to expand the convention center in South Boston. And while there's been some criticism of that, there's not enough scrutiny. What this piece and Jacoby's column focuses on is Greg Sullivan, former inspector general, now at the Pioneer Institute, picking up on the fact that $100 million is slipped into this thing, no one knows by whom, that essentially is a subsidy for a hotel developer, a private hotel developer. Well, it gets worse, at least as far as I read this, and again, please correct me, that the hotel developer will be chosen by the head of the Convention Center Authority, Jim Rooney, who we've talked to many a time. So essentially what is happening is Beacon Hill slipped in $100 million for a private developer, and one individual that nobody voted for, Jim, except his board, Jim Rooney, gets to decide who to write a $100 million check to.
Excuse me.
And if Greg Sullivan hadn't said anything, our money would have gone to this thing?
You left something out about Jim Rooney. We all like Jim Rooney. He's a great guy.
He's a very good
guy. But Jim got Rooney retired from the T at like 40 years
41,
old.
41, yeah.
And then he went on to work for the Convention Center Authority. The governor had to cut back on his salary because it was so huge. What was he making, $360,000?
Whatever it was.
I think he was cut. Do you know how much he was cut by? Anyway, the governor, Deval Patrick, stepped in and said $360,000 was a little bit too much, and collecting two pensions from the state of Massachusetts was too much.
But so it was all legal. So
it's all legal.
But can we get back to this for a second? Is anybody worked in a frenzy? This is $100 million of our money that would have slid through had Brian Joyce, the Senate committee chair, not deleted this from the bill. It still may get through. $100 million for a private developer. Isn't that scandalous?
It is. I share your outrage, but I just want to tell you, I don't want to count how many convention center columns I've written. It's like howling at the moon. What you say, nothing will change. That money will come through. They will get what they want. People have drunk the Kool-Aid, whatever cliche.
Well, can I sound
use.
Even more naive than I sound already? If we had 200 state reps sitting in this room, reps and 40 senators, that's all they have, 240, and said, tell us three things about this $1.1 billion thing you're about, could any of them, well, I assume the chairs of the committee, could more than four of them say what's in the billion-dollar bill?
No, but they will tell you that it means jobs and development for the convention center.
Right.
Yeah.
And business for the restaurants, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not quite as outraged on this. But I also have to say that...
what are you, a hotel developer?
Well, this
conventioneer.
My wife is in a related business. So,
oh,
so
wow.
The thing is, and I've... Look, going back many years, they screwed up when they decided to put the convention center in South Boston, which, by the way, they should have done it at Crosstown, as Joe Corcoran was going to do. But Tom Menino wanted it to be in South Boston.
What do you mean,
Crosstown?
It's another name for Roxbury.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
okay.
Down by Boston Medical Center.
Okay.
There was going to be a megaplex. This was the whole big thing. Was back then, in 94, Menino and the Southie guys, politicians, all gamed the system to put it in South Boston. And the idea was that they were going to have this whole huge development around it of many hotels that were supposed to have been open by 2004 when the convention center opened, so that you could have big conventions where everybody stayed there and it became a lively thing. And they screwed that up, and I won't get into the whole, how that all happened, but they're still trying to get out from behind the eight ball on that now. So as they're trying to do this expansion, you need the hotels to go along with the expansion, or else it's still going to be a situation of, well, we can't get the extra groups to come.
Can I interrupt you? I'm not against the hotel. I am against slipping $100 million into a billion-dollar bill that people don't understand to begin with. And two, I am against having one individual who no one had a chance to vote for deciding what private developer to give $100 million wet kiss to.
And what I was going to say is one of the problems that happened in 2004 is that it was set up as a bid where basically the lowest bidder, just plain lowest bidder wins,
That's not part of this deal.
Right. So, well... But that turned out to be a bad idea because you had basically Starwood Properties came in and rigged the system by putting in a phony false bid. And then once they got the contract, they had the state by the...
We know that.
So anyway, so they were trying to do something a little different where... You get much too into weird details of things.
I mean,
stop talking because nobody's paying
attention
to you.
So are you going to write another dozen columns on this or what? Are you going to do something?
Well, Jeff wrote a great one.
He did write
a great one. He did.
Wrote a great
Absolutely.
One. I defer to him for the moment.
Well, something you did write about briefly.
I love this.
Marjorie and I. Well, you take it, Marjorie. Then.
Well, you had a great anecdote. A nice mayor needs a vision. That was talking about the new mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh. But before we get to his vision or lack thereof, you had to tell a great anecdote about an employee that was known as a bully at City Hall. What happened to this employee, please, with Mayor Walsh?
Well, when Mayor Walsh came into office, he was given some advice that he should just get rid of the person. He might have followed that. But instead, he called the guy into his office and told him that from now on, he was going to be nice to people. We're nice to people now. That's the new Walsh administration.
That.
And I think that's a...
No more screaming and yelling.
That's a good part of a Marty Walsh vision.
Tenor
and attitude of
I think it
government.
Is. I think it's a very different attitude, at least coming in, a very different attitude from the Menino administration and a very welcome change.
But there's another piece in your column that I liked even more. Now, this is the gossipy part of this. It's not the big vision thing. On the I'm reading from Jones' column. On the other, the meaning Hand, the new mayor and the ex-mayor have been sharing the stage more than anyone anticipated. Walsh has been gracious about it, but asked about the many events featuring the former and current mayors. He said, quote, "I can tell you this. When I am done with being the mayor of Boston, I'm going to retire. I'm going to let the next mayor do the job. You can't have two mayors." That's pretty heavy comment about Tom Menino.
I was
is it
glad
not?
That I had it on tape.
Great quote.
So that he couldn't say he didn't say it. Yeah, I was surprised that he said it, but not really. I mean, I think that Mayor Walsh has been very gracious. And there are only so many times you could do that scene, what they did at Fenway Park, where Tom Menino comes out and hands him the ball, yeah. And then he throws it. With all due respect to Tom Menino, he is the former mayor. And it's time for Walsh to have the stage. I mean, Menino was much less gracious, as we know, with his predecessor, Ray Flynn.
Yeah.
By the way, Ray Flynn has told us one of the reasons he's told us on air, so we have this on tape, too. One of the reasons they don't get along, he told us a couple of months ago, is that Tom Menino never called him and asked him to do anything. He says he just all he wanted, according to him, was Tom Menino to call and say, "Mr. Mayor, I'd like you to help me with X or Y or whatever it is." And the fact that he was never asked, at least according to Flynn, is the reason for the bad feeling. I'm sorry, David, I interrupted you.
No. I think that's part of, you know, Menino's MO was always you don't share the limelight with anybody. Everything is about him. And, you know, and we're already seeing this with the Walsh administration. I think he's much more willing to have, you know, whether it's Sheila Dillon at Housing or, you know, Felix Arroyo or John Barris, wherever, get some credit for things rather than everything being about the mayor. And so, you know, this is part
of
that.
And that matters. I mean, I think that really matters because, you know, you think back years and years ago to the White administration where he surrounded himself with really talented people that had a huge impact on the city. That was a big fall. I mean, we've had a love fest with Tom, and, you know, I know everybody loves him. But one of the things, if you don't share the credit and if you're afraid of really smart people around you, it hurts the city of Boston.
Right, just to
obviously.
Pick up on what David just said, the Boston Magazine has a really great piece by Paul McMorrow about, again, about the different era, the Walsh era, and mm-hmm. what he's doing to the VRA. And one anecdote that didn't make it into the column, because the column only has so many words, Mayor Walsh was mentioning how when Boston Magazine said that they wanted to interview John Barros, somebody came to Walsh and said, "Is it okay? Can he talk to them?"
Right.
And
that's
he said,
great.
"Of course they yeah. can.
That's great.
Of course
right.
they can."
And it's, you know, from the Menino playbook, you don't want that to happen because then John Barros becomes a political power in his own right, and that becomes a problem, you know. And but clearly, at least for now, Marty Walsh wants the other model where you do let these people, you know, gain power and gain their own prestige.
You know, I told this to Jim before. I was at an event, the Italianissimo event that Jared Bowen, actually, who's going to be with us later in the show, the arts editor here, he was the co-hosted with Jenny Johnson mm-hmm. Of the Globe and issue with Nesson now.
Nesson, yeah.
Anyway, and Walsh got up to give a little welcoming speech, and of course, Mayor Menino's Italian. And he gave a beautiful shout-out to Mayor Menino that he didn't have to do. It was a very, like, a 3 or 4 minute discussion, and I thought you would never have seen this in the reverse. Marty right. Walsh mentioning in a fond way the mayor.
Here's the test. We'll see of whether, you know, Menino will go quietly is when it's time for the Christmas tree lightings around the city. Because that's the one he would
together?
Never, Menino would
yes,
never.
Yes, he said he had to show him how to do it, I think.
That is what he said. That's exactly.
No one's ever been allowed to light a Christmas tree in Boston other than Tom Menino for 20 years now.
Okay.
David Bernstein, Joan Vinaki, it's good to see you both.
Thank
Thanks
you both
so much for
coming
time,
in. David Bernstein is a contributing editor to Boston Magazine and WGBH's political analyst. Joan Vinaki is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Up next, when it comes to the lottery, is it a lose-lose for poor districts and a win-win for the tonier parts of town? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, Jared Bowen will have the results of a new report on the importance of the state of the arts on our local economy. That's tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Saturday, July 12th, it's the WGBH Fun Fest, packed with music, games, and all the ice cream you can eat. A family four-pack is yours for a gift of just $35. Online at wgbh.org/funfest.
Support for our programs comes from you and Ferguson Bath Kitchen and Lighting Gallery, featuring products for your kitchen and bath, including Growy Agira bath faucets inspired by hand crafting techniques. Locations at ferguson.com. And Harvard Extension School, offering part-time master's programs in psychology, English, and international relations. Info session June 11th. Details and more information available at extension.harvard.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And last year, the state lottery raked in close to $5 billion. That means you gambled $5 billion. And for the most part, you lost close to $5 billion. They made money off everything from Keno to Powerball to scratch tickets. And as we know, people who spend most of that $5 billion in the hope of making it bigger, people who can't afford to lose it. And these people, it turns out, end up losing twice. Let's take Chelsea as an example. It's one of the poorest cities, and the residents are amongst the most enthusiastic lottery players. Last year alone, the average man, woman, and child bet more than $1,100. But as the Globe reports a couple of days ago, they get back far less from the state than what they gamble in. Well, compare that to places like Brookline, Marjorie's hometown.
That's right. We love it.
Where the
Can't
town,
get enough.
The town of Brookline gets back 2.5 times as much from the state as the residents of Brookline gamble on the lottery. So it's sort of, I guess you could call it a Robin Hood in reverse, taking from the poor, giving to the rich. So we have some questions for you at 877-301-8970. What's the solution? Should we obliterate the lottery altogether and just raise taxes in an equal amount to the revenue that would be roughly a half point in the income tax? Or should state aid just be distributed, let's say preferentially, to cities and towns who spend the most on lottery, the Chelseas, the poorer communities that really pump money into the lottery? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I want to be fair. I just wrote a piece for the Sunday Globe magazine a couple of weeks ago on
this. We know that.
The lottery.
You told us that many times.
Thank you. It's 42 years old. By many measures, Marjorie, it's one of the most successful in the country, meaning that it returns the most money in prizes. Most money goes out to cities and towns, close to $1 billion. But you know, also we're number one in, which shocks most people when I tell them.
That we gamble that much.
By far.
I was stunned.
The second most money per person gambled on the lottery, I think it's Georgia and District of Columbia, is practically only half, a little bit more than half of what we spend here. Let me repeat that. Every man, woman, and child, most children are not playing the lottery yet, but they're included in this, spend $700 a year in Massachusetts. The poorer the community, the more you spend. Like Chelsea, $1,100. Places like Weston, $45 per every man, woman, and child. And again, there are many communities, the Chelseas, the Reveres, the Haverhills, which spend a ton, don't get as much back from the state. And the Brooklines and the Miltons get much more back from the state than their people get. It is really a you-know-what backwards kind of system. Well, so we want to know what you'd do. Would you fix it by having the money go back in a much more equitable way to the places where it's being gambled? Again, that's mostly poorer communities. Or would you get rid of it altogether, which I know is a pipe dream kind of thing, but it is my dream.
It is a pipe dream kind of thing. We know you're obsessed with this,
Jim. I'm obsessed with it, I am.
As the former Congressman Barney Frank said, Jim Browdy wants to tell everybody how to spend their money. Isn't that what he told you?
He did. He did when he was yelling at me once. Yes, he did.
Yelling at you many times. It is true. You want to tell everybody how to spend their money. Although, you know, there could be a—I mean, I have no problem with them giving back to the poor communities more than they're giving to
the— That's kind of you.
Yes, but, you know—
Considering that's where the money's coming from.
You could see a campaign in Chelsea where there'd be pressure on people to gamble more because if you just spend an extra $5, we'll get a new community center. We'll get a new senior citizen center. You know, put the pressure on to spend more than they're already spending. So,
are you not appalled by this situation?
I am appalled, Jim.
Well, are you saying that just to amuse me, or are you actually?
No, I think it is pretty outrageous that Brookline, where there's a lot of very wealthy people, gets so much money back from the state.
More than they put in by
On the other hand, Fall River, which is my hometown, they get a lot of money back from the state, and I'm glad they do because they need the money.
Okay, one more thing before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970. Do you play the lottery? Are you happy with the way it works in terms of? There is a little bit of a Robin Hood in reverse kind of thing, but I'll get to you in a minute. How do you feel about the fact that in Chelsea, Marjorie, one of the poorest communities in the state, the average person, and again, this includes people who don't play, $1,179. You know what that means?
Jim.
That means some people are spending $2,000-$3,000 a year.
Well, you know what it also means?
What?
They're keeping hope alive, Jim. You know, if their average salary is, what is it, $15,000? I mean, they're
Did you read my story in the Globe?
I read your story.
What was the opening paragraph about? And you've had the same experience.
This is another one of Jim's obsession, that every time you see somebody that's over 65 in there at the 7-Eleven buying a lottery ticket, leaving with cat food, he's convinced that the cat food is not for the cat.
But for
it
them.
It is for the elderly person that's got cat food in one hand and a stack of lottery
tickets.
How
many times you stood in line behind a really old person with a stack of lottery tickets, like on a Powerball or a Mass Millions day, and you say to yourself, there's no way they have this money.
You know what one of the great things is about this, and it is because mostly lower-income people do gamble, it's usually lower-income people that win. You know, some guy that's been in a factory for like 45 years, suddenly he's got $25 million. Often it doesn't turn out that well. They kind of blow through the money really quickly. But lots of times they don't. And they have this great...
You're kidding, right?
What?
You're kidding that the while it may be that a millionaire here or there is someone who's a working class soul, the vast majority of people lose their money. If they didn't lose their money, there wouldn't be $1 billion going to cities and towns.
But if people that are over 21 or over 18, as I have to be 18 to gamble, I guess.
Theoretically, yes.
If you're over 18 and you're making $15,000 a year and you're making $20,000 a year and you're not getting, you know, you're barely able to pay your bills and you want to go in and spend $5 a week on lottery tickets.
So you're not concerned.
Because you might think that just maybe I'll win. It makes you feel better. You want to be able to do it. You know, who are you?
$1,200. You don't have a problem with a system that funds your state government? Excuse me, Marjorie. You know how your town of Brookline gets 2.5 times as much as it puts into the lottery? Because people in Chelsea spend almost $1,200 per every man, woman, and child. That's how you get your money.
Yes. Well, here's the problem.
Does that trouble you?
Here's the problem, Jim.
What is it?
People in Massachusetts are paying very, very high property taxes in a lot of these cities and towns. And it's very difficult to convince people to raise taxes, even the state level and the income tax, which wouldn't hit them as much. It's very difficult to
So let's have poor people play the lottery instead.
Well,
is that the fallback?
I don't know that you are the czar who should be telling people.
Well, obviously
how
I'm not. I understand that.
No, you've got to be in your bonnet about this, Jim.
Well, you know what you should do, Marjorie? If you are willing to turn back the money, the share of the money that comes to your hometown, your adopted hometown of Brookline, that came from Chelsea and Haverhill, I am willing to drop the argument. But you're not, are you?
I'm with you on the towns like Chelsea and the poor towns, you know, Springfield, whatever, those towns should get back more. Absolutely. That's like the education thing. The poor towns should get more money than the rich towns. I'm for that. This is just a piece of the pie, Jim. What you're really about is getting rid of the lottery.
If I were the czar of the of revenue raising in Massachusetts, I confess, I would get rid. And by the way, the one last thing about this, and I'll try to
The question is, why hasn't it been done?
The point of my piece 2 Sundays ago, since you asked, Marjorie, did
it was
you
in
just
the Boston
ask
Globe?
What was the point of my piece? It was the Sunday Globe
the
magazine.
The point of your piece was that every elderly person who's buying lottery tickets is eating cat food.
No, it's not my point.
That was the point of your piece.
Even though it was one of my points.
Okay, what was your
My primary point was, if you get to vote on casinos in November, and we still don't know if the Supreme Judicial Court is going to allow you to vote up or down on casinos, that isn't the right question. The right question is, do you want to add casinos to the billions and billions and billions of dollars that's already being gambled in Massachusetts? If you do, fine, then vote yes. But don't consider casinos in isolation. They're part of what is becoming a gambling industrial complex in Massachusetts. The governor's here Thursday. I'll have this debate with him because obviously I'm getting nowhere with you. 877-301-8970.
Let's start with Dan from Worcester. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Hi, Maggie and Jim.
Hey there.
A couple of comments. One, I'm going to be appalled seeing Jim, or possibly seeing Jim on the streets of Worcester in the upcoming convention.
I'll be there.
But I want to say that I agree with you on this one, Jim. I think that I don't know what calculations that they use to determine all this stuff, but I believe that the money should go back to the cities and towns as it is. However, I think that proportionally, if a town or a city spends X amount of dollars on their lottery program, then they should get whatever calculation comes back from that expenditure, and nothing different. If one town spends $1 million on lottery and they get a certain percentage, then that should be it. If a town next to it only spends $500,000, then they should get the proportional amount of that, not like be the same all the way across the board.
Well, there is a, it's not quite across the board. It takes into account property, the value of property, but it doesn't take into account, apparently, I hope I get this right, incomes of people. And it just so happens, coincidentally, the places that are gambling the most on the lottery are places where the income levels of people are low. So some adjustment should be made. I'm not sure exactly what it should be,
absolutely,
but some adjustment. What's your second point?
Trust the state to confuse this thing. Why don't you just make it simple and just simply, if your town or city plays X amount, then you get a percentage and that's it.
Well, can I make it even, Dan, let me make it even simpler than if your town or city gambles. I think Marjorie would support this. Why don't we just have direct deposit where your check can go directly to the lottery, so you don't have to worry about the middleman, namely you. Dan, thanks for the call. I'll see you in Worcester on Saturday. Wave to me when I drive.
You know, you haven't shed your speculation on why it is this way. I assume it has to do with the power of the different reps from the different cities and towns.
Where the votes are. I mean, by the way, one of the communities that gets more in Boston, according to a graphic in the Globe, lottery sales contributed, meaning gambled, is $105 million. Guess how much Boston gets back in state aid? $160 million. 50% more than they gamble. Boston's got a lot of reps and senators. If you're a Boston State rep or senator, you love the system exactly as it is.
It doesn't explain Brookline. I don't know. There's a lot of powerhouse legislators in Brookline.
Well, you know, we should do. My understanding from reading the Globe story that followed mine a couple of days later, I should mention the person's name who wrote it. My apologies. Her name is Catherine Cloutier, I believe is how you say it. I believe she wrote that the governor is on the side of a more equitable formula. We'll ask him about it. The governor will be with us Thursday in the studio from noon to one. You could talk to him about it as well.
Let's go to Dan from Arlington.
Don,
from Arlington. Hi, Don.
Hi. I know Jim doesn't like to have any fun, but there are a couple things that that I think he's forgetting.
What's that?
Number one, when you count the amount of money that goes back to the community, you got to count the amount of money that is won in the lottery. And presumably, the towns who have the highest percentage of people paying into the lottery also have the highest percentage of people who are winning the lottery.
I assume that's
quite
true.
That's a great point, Don.
Yeah.
And the other point is that I think that an awful lot of people in Brookline and Cambridge, they're just afraid to be seen walking into the convenience store, so they head over to Everett and Chelsea, buy their lottery tickets, and then go home.
Now, I can speak it for one Canterbridgian me. Every time one of those things hits like a third of $1 billion, I am at the convenience store in the center of Central Square, proudly buying my ticket. Hey, Don, thank you for the call.
That is a great point.
Which one?
You wonder how many people are sneaking across town lines.
So they aren't seen by their...
Well, yeah. I mean, if you go to South Boston, South Boston's getting more expensive now, but when it used to be not so expensive, that was the big lines of Flanagan Supermarket. There were always these huge
lines. You think
lines.
Most people from Brookline are driving over to Chelsea to buy their lottery tickets? I don't think so.
No, but they could be going across into Boston. You know what I mean? They could come in up. They could go to Austin or Brighton, Jim, very easily.
Yeah, 877-301-8970. The point that, again, that is being lost, that in my estimation, is the casino thing is being looked at in isolation. It is part of, we spend $5 billion on the lottery already. There is Suffolk Downs as well.
That's right.
Obviously,
well,
it's not a huge enterprise.
If the court decides that the casino issue can go on the ballot, mm-hmm. then people will vote. And they'll decide if they want to get rid of
the
casino.
But would you not agree the whole casino debate so far has been cast on whether you want casinos and a slots parlor or don't want casinos and a slots parlor, as opposed to the context, which I think really matters. 877, I may be alone, 301-8970, 877-301-8970. In fairness to the lottery, and by the way, we can talk to Grossman about this, too. I just realized he's the treasurer. He's in charge of the lottery, even though he doesn't do the distribution formula. The legislature does. He'll be with us tomorrow. In their defense, since we do have a lottery and it's the law, they run it very well. It is the most efficient, most money, as I said, returned in prizes, lowest overhead, I believe, is a percentage of total revenue. So if you have a lottery, if you want to have a lottery, the Massachusetts is doing a wonderful job. It's just too much money.
Now, if the little old lady that you're concerned about that goes in to buy her stack of lottery tickets and with the cat food on the other hand, mm-hmm. would she make out better if she were in there at the slot machine in the casino getting free food and cocktails? Don't you get free food or very low-priced food?
I told you, when I was in Reno, which I've often, one of the two places I've ever been,
sneak off to.
No, I was there, and I was at Lake Tahoe. And on the way, I went to Reno, which is, as I've described, I think I did in that piece, as a homeless shelter with slot machines, which is essentially what Reno is. It is grotesque. The food is pretty cheap and the entertainment is pretty cheap, but that's one of the ways they lure you in. I used to have this, the late great Chet Curtis, and I used to argue about this. Our desks were next to each other, and he's a pro casino guy, and I drove him nuts with my anti-gambling kind of thing. And he said, you know, he apparently never gambled. He said, you should go to a casino, go to the show, have a fabulous dinner. No one requires you to go lose your money.
That's an excellent point.
Which is a decent point.
That's an excellent point.
It's an excellent point. But the problem is the data shows, particularly with things like the lot. Did you see the scratch ticket story in the Globe the other day? They now have a $30 scratch ticket. They just started, which I bought to write this piece. I scratch off all 30 things. I won nothing. They've sold somewhere, I hope I get this right, in the neighborhood of $90 million in the first month or whatever.
Well, don't you see what the appeal is?
Yeah.
For 30,
bankruptcy, that's the appeal.
Instead of just scratching off one, you scratch off 30, and for those 30, you have that anticipation of maybe today is your lucky day.
Yeah. That was not my lucky day.
I know, but I mean, I think that's why people do it.
$30 for a scratch ticket. How can you not see that this is an issue?
You know what you should do, Jim?
What's that?
You should go to the liquor store and tell people they can't buy the expensive brand of vodka. They're going to buy the rotten gut vodka. They're going to buy the cheap beer because, God forbid, if they're only making $15,000 a year, they should splurge on a good bottle of scotch.
No, if you go to a good liquor store, let me just say, they will be able to tell you know how you match. Like when we have Jonathan Alsop here, he tells us how to match the right wine. They can tell you what wine goes perfectly with puppy chow or whatever cat food you're eating because you've gambled away all your income on lottery tickets.
Viziani, I hope I pronounced that correctly in the car. Did I get it right?
Hi there.
Yes, you did. Thank you for getting my call.
Thank you.
How are you guys doing today?
Great. Thank you for the call.
I think that the money should be distributed according with the amount of contribution town by town. And also, I just think that the lottery itself is not, they don't really care about the people and the poverty line because, you know, every holiday they make new scratch tickets. And then the Powerball that used to be $1 now is $2 because gambling is very addicted. And I say that because my husband, half of his salary goes in gambling.
Half?
Like when the Powerball went to half, when the Powerball went to $2, I never bought again. But he kept buying it and buying it. So hiring the prices is also a way to make the poor be more poor.
Now, Viziani, how much?
So they don't stop.
Let's test out Marjorie's theory. Your husband is gambling half of your family's income.
That's a lot of money.
How much is he winning?
Nothing.
Thank you.
Nothing.
So, Viziani, somebody that's affected by this personally, what do you think about having casinos in Massachusetts?
I'm absolutely against because this is like a disease. When people get hooked to it, they can stop.
Viziani, you're singing my tune. Thank you. Listen, good luck with the family finances, and thank you for the call.
That's horrible.
It is horrible. It is. You know, it is an addiction. I mean, it is an addiction. You know, the studies have shown with casinos
the closer
that
you are,
if you're within a 50-mile radius.
Yeah, the addiction goes up. You're absolutely right.
But, I mean, that's
such the weird thing about this gambling thing, that we're going to bring in all these casinos if anybody ever accepts them or they ever get them built. And at the same time, we're going to put all this money into prevention. I mean, it's just sort of bizarre. I mean, it's good
we're
going to
create addiction and then we're going to help treat it.
I mean, it's crazy. Matt from Marlboro. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, how are you? I guess it's my lucky day. I got on the radio with you.
Yes,
we'll find out. Hi there, Matt.
Now, look, I am not a degenerate gambler, but the solving of this equation is the casinos, because you know that Donald Trump doesn't go to the corner store and grab a scratch ticket, but he will come to a plush Plaza Hotel style casino and lay down a fairly large amount of change.
By the way, I'm glad. Let me interrupt you to say it is factually true what Matt said, and I'm sorry to make that clear before. The economic status of the average gambler at a casino is somewhat higher. It's not still, the average person is not the Donald Trumpian kind of person, but it is higher income than are people who play the lottery. It's a good point, Matt.
If you want to balance this out, if you look at this as a form of taxation, and I, of course, do look at this as a form of taxation, it's voluntary taxation, we need to make sure that when we have a casino, because we have to have a casino to balance out the scratch ticket. Anybody who is interested in tax fairness and tax equity is making sure that we have a casino that's going to attract the high rollers, because these are the people we want to tax.
Okay, Matt, thank you for the call. So his Matt's position is, if I'm troubled by the inequity of lottery and scratch tickets and Keno and all that sort of thing, casino gambling will balance it out. You know, I didn't mention, because I didn't want to out you, but since it's in there, in my piece in the Globe, I mentioned going to a restaurant in somewhere near Fall River.
It's in Somerset.
I didn't mention, it was actually with Marjorie. And we went to a restaurant where there was Keno being played. We didn't go there because it was Keno. We went there because she had told me this is the best spaghetti and meatballs ever. And
you ridiculed the spaghetti and meatballs the whole
weak.
Time. I didn't say they're the best spaghetti and meatballs
ever. Well, you did,
ever.
Actually. And it turns out they were the worst. But what was that experience like for you who are happy? What was it like having a Keno game on every table?
Yeah,
what was that like?
It doesn't really add to your dining pleasure.
You don't think
really,
so?
No, it seems a little kind of low rent, yeah. a little tacky. But again, I mean... You know, you want to tell everybody what to do, Jim. That's the bottom line.
No, I don't
want
to tell
everybody. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. It's, except for certain things. You want to legalize pot, but you want to control everything else that goes on.
No, but Marjorie, see, the thing you're missing, your government and my government, the listener's government, is the one which is authorizing the lottery, giving the licenses for casinos. So it's being done in our name. It's not like people just are going out to some private entity that opened on its own. These are sanctioned by your state government. And as a result of it, again, we will talk to Steve Grossman about it tomorrow. He's the treasurer. The treasurer's in charge of the lottery. And we'll talk to the governor on Thursday about the whole distribution formula, because that's something that apparently he's on the other side of from where the legislature is.
I think you can write another column about this in the Boston Globe.
I'm worked into a frenzy. I'm going to shut up after this. My issue is not outcomes all the time. My issue is lack of debate all the time. This is something that merits this whole distribution formula and the way we raise money should be a topic of conversation, not just the issuance of a new scratch ticket every couple of... No, I'm serious. I mean, would you not agree with that at least? Let's have a debate.
I could have seen in the car scratching away 30 times that little scratch ticket.
Can I tell
How
you?
Big is the scratch ticket, by the way?
It's like as big as your upper body.
Yeah.
No, it's
was
large.
It fun?
It's huge fun. I wasn't worried I'd be caught. I was going to go buy another one.
Okay, this is why people
They tell
do
you,
it,
yeah, but your odds of winning are great. So I scratch one, I scratch two, I scratch 23, 24, I'm getting to 28. And finally, I was 30
exactly.
for 30, not a penny.
Totally disillusioned.
Not a penny.
Okay, up next, it is time for All Revved Up. The Reverend Irene Monroe and the Reverend Emmett Price join us to talk about transgender rights and black college graduates and the job market. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, reporter Kirk Carapezza delivers voices of students, faculty, and administrators. On Campus is our higher ed blog, available right now at WGBHnews.org.
WGBH and the Boston Globe announced the dates for this year's Boston Summer Arts Weekend. 2 days of live music, food, and festivities in Boston's Copley Square, July 26th and 27th, presented by Citizens Bank.
WGBH programs exist because of you. An innuendo featuring Hunter Douglas Duet Arcatella insulating shades for controlling the light and heat that summer brings. Room darkening shades available as well as motorized and skylight systems. Hunter Douglas at innuendo and innuendo.com. And Inspector George Gently. Martin Shaw stars as the inspector whose brutal honesty makes him feared by criminals and colleagues alike. Don't miss Inspector George Gently. Tonight at 9 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us as they do on Mondays for All Revved Up are Reverend Irene Monroe, syndicated columnist. You can find it at the Huffington Post and Bay Windows. And Reverend Emmett Price. He is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture, Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Good to see you both.
Hey, great to be back.
Great to see you. Great to see you both. So Orange is the New Black, big Netflix hit, debuted over the weekend. People have maybe gone through all the new episodes already, but it's the second season, very popular hit. Features a transgender person, Laverne Cox. She was on the cover of Time magazine.
That's right.
Now we've got this Dr. Cameron Partridge. He's going to make history. 22nd of June, the first openly transgender preach a priest, excuse me. He'll be preaching at the historic Washington National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. So I'm wondering, as Time Magazine put it, are we now at the next threshold? Are we crossing the threshold with transgender rights? What do you think, Irene Monroe?
We definitely are. I know Cameron. We were in the doctoral program together. Absolutely. And I am so delighted to see him, you know, be the speaker this year. It's just absolutely wonderful. But not only is transgender rights the new, you know, sort of frontier, but the Episcopal Church, surprisingly, is leading it, a church that is known as, you know, it's chosen frozen. Absolutely. But interestingly enough, its left-leaning arm of the church has always been progressive with the first ordination of
Jean
a woman.
Robinson.
With Barbara
Harris. Barbara Harris, sure,
in 1989.
Right. Being
the first woman and African American at that, and of course, you know, Jean Robinson, but having a profound role in the anti-slavery movement, and Paul Revere's, you know, cry out for freedom. So
I thought you were going to say Paul Revere was transgender. I was going to say
we don't know. Some of those outfits those boys wore now.
We haven't uncovered that yet.
Okay, now we should deconstruct that.
You know,
absolutely.
Emmett Price, Irene Monroe in classic Irene Monroe fashion, when Marjorie asked her the question, so is the next frontier transgender rights? Yeah, we're there, we're this. I'm not quite sure that America is there yet. According to Time Magazine, half of 1% of Americans are transgender. I was surprised, actually, the number was that high. And this comes on the heels of the gay marriage movement. Like, literally, you blink and there's another state judge or a federal judge who has declared that their state constitution does not allow for discrimination against same-sex couples. And so maybe that's causing a lot of people to say, well, if that's moving so quickly, transgender rights is going to move quickly on its heels. I'm not buying it. That seems to me, and again, this is anecdotal, this is not based on any research, that the, how should I describe this? That the comfort level that a lot of people who are pretty tolerant, whom I know, have with this is nowhere near what the comfort level was, let's say, I don't know, 20 years ago on the issue of gay rights and then ultimately gay marriage. Am I off base or not?
Well, I think you make a great point. I mean, I think this is a great story and certainly history in the making, but you're right. I mean, this has been a long time coming, right? So it's not that it's been a two-week crusade and that we're here and that there are a number of people who have been fighting over the years, over the decades to really, you know, create some visibility, to create some equality and create some inclusivity, not only in the church, but in terms of society.
On gay rights, you're
on
talking
gay rights,
yeah.
You know, gay rights, transgender rights and gender identity rights. And so I think we're making great progress. I think when you look back across the hands of time, we'll see all of those trailblazers who have been working in, you know, in the trenches for many years. But this is a great moment. And I don't want to truncate and or even diminish the impact of this moment that we're in now.
But this moment has been going on. The reason why we even have an LGBTQ civil rights movement has everything to do with the Stonewall riots down in the Village in 1969. And were it not for...
As in Greenwich Village.
That's right. Right. And were it not for, but back in the day, they called them drag queens, but those transgendered Latino and Black folks kicking off their heels and kicking some butt, we wouldn't have the kind of movement that we have today. You're absolutely right. I mean, transgendered people have a higher rate of unemployment, absolutely have to fight for health rights, absolutely have to even fight to just, you know, negotiate or navigate through their day. Absolutely. But I think as more and more of transgender people come out and are in more visible places, we're seeing this acceptance. And more, and interestingly enough, you know, again, I just have to say this, you know, as we always have these, I was having a conversation with my partner. And I said, you know, I was a LAG, meaning a lesbian after graduation. We have this, and we have LUGs. This was college, lesbian until graduation. Yeah. But Thea said to me, she was a LAB, a lesbian, you know, after birth. And so, you know, there are people who know their sexual...
LAGs, LUGs,
and LABs.
Okay.
That's right.
Anything else to add in there?
There are some others, but we don't have to. But my point about it is that that the time that I'm coming up, I couldn't even say this. And the fact that we have space, open space, and tolerance for that, more and more people are, and kids are coming out at younger and younger ages. So no, I think we're there. We have to move it, you know, systemically. I mean, laws have to be changed. We got to address ENDA, but God knows what change we have seen since 1969.
Well, let me just say, I guess I'll temper my own comments about not so fast, not because I don't want to see it move, mm-hmm. but because I have to be honest. I consider myself a pretty tolerant person. I have some, I wouldn't say anxiety. I have some something. It's not as easy a starter for as the transgender stuff, even though I like to think that, again, I am as supportive as one can be for someone who's not transgender. I think the big breakthrough, and obviously this is why she was on the cover of Time magazine. It always takes somebody high profile, as you say, who somebody can relate to. I mean, whether it was Ellen DeGeneres, all of a sudden, we love her. She's our favorite daytime person. Well, she's a lesbian. Well, wait a second. Lesbians probably aren't that bad. In fact, they're great. I mean, look at her. Right. I mean, the Laverne Cox thing, I think, helps. But it's still going to be it seems to me, a much more difficult slog than the optimists are suggesting it's going to be.
The issue is that when you have a high-profile individual, and I'm not suggesting that it's easier for them, but there's a lot of protection that occurs when you have a high-profile individual. But when you have the everyday, you know, Jane, Jim, or whatever person it is, there are safety issues. Violence issues.
But see, Laverne Cox, as well as Janet Mock, who's written a bestseller book, Redefining Realness, will tell you, because they are more profile, they're more likely to be assaulted. Because it's this whole notion of to folks who look at certain transgendered people who can't pass, you know, the gender that they're presenting.
Right.
And so they are more likely, just on contact, to be assaulted. Similarly, those of us who are gay and lesbian, who look what people perceive to be typically queer, and stuff. So no, not at all.
But that's a part of the decision making process when one walks into their courageous being. Right. At that level. But when you're 11 years old,
that's not a decision. See, we don't decide. No, we don't decide. No,
but I think you're misinterpreting where I think Emmett is going. I think what you're saying, and you didn't use these words, is it provides some level of cover. I mean, and I don't mean cover in a traditional sense.
When
you
say
exactly, you say, well, maybe I shouldn't be as fearful as I am. And no one is denying, Irene, that this is not an easy path for people. But the reality is when there's a Laverne Cox, just like now there's a Michael Sam. And a Jason Collins and whatever, I like to think it makes it somewhat easier, at least for the next generation.
I think that where people do get freaked out, and this is why you had this horrible, demeaning discussion about the bathroom bill.
Right.
I think you got to be real. If you are a mother with two little girls or a little boy, whatever, and you're in the bathroom in some public place, and there's a 6'4", 220-pound woman that comes into the bathroom, people freak out. I think that still is a reality that's going to be hard for transgender people to get past that, I think.
I think the wonderful thing about it is that it really knocks out this, quote, what we define as the feminine-female paradigm. So when you see this six-footer coming in, and clearly it's transgendered, it helps all of us and frees us from this sort of, you know, patriarchal notion of what is male and female, and this gender fluidity allows you to live more authentically in the fullness of who you are. I just think it's this movement, as I felt the bisexual movement showed us, the fluidity in both of those important categories that we've only looked at in terms of in a binary kind of construction.
So one last thing about this. So how do you get to the point where the people aren't going to be freaked out when they see somebody who's a 6'4" woman?
How do you get to the point?
We have 6-footers anyway. You know, I think that the Obama girls, okay, I think those girls going clear.
Well, they're
going
to be tall. But you know what I'm saying? A big guy that could be playing football, and it's not a guy.
How do you get
woman.
To the point where a majority of if I had said to you 10 years ago, a majority of Americans are going to be supportive of two women getting married or two men getting married?
I think there is a fear. That's what I'm saying. I don't think you walk down the street and see two gay guys and necessarily think, oh my goodness, I'm afraid. Or two lesbian women.
Well, there was, though, Marge.
Did you ever hear the great Jimmy Tingle routine? Here. Jimmy Tingle does a great routine about when he was a kid and first hearing about gays, he said, I was totally, and I'm paraphrasing, and boy, he was, I was totally convinced that somebody was going to jump out of the bushes and want to have sex with me.
That's
I mean,
right.
there was that mindset.
And the ick factor is still there when Michael Sam, the football player,
yeah.
kissed his partner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, I thought, let me tell you what I thought. I thought, okay, folks going to get crazy because it's an interracial relationship. See, this is where I'm thinking, okay? They were got crazy because, you know,
two guys
kissed.
I don't know. I think it's different when I think there's a physical fear.
Oh, it is different. I'm just saying.
It's definitely different. It's definitely different. But there has to be a forward motion in society, right?
And the assaults on them are greater because of that.
So how do you get there, Emmett Price?
I think society's always been playing catch up. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, we're still dealing with race, and here we are dealing with, you know, gender identity and whatnot. So I think that the challenge is to be willing to have the conversation and to be willing to do the introspective piece, right? The conversation with yourself, right? Because as a six foot black man, when I walk into the bathroom and only white businessmen are there, everyone looks over their shoulder too.
Okay, yeah. But you
right,
know what
so,
though?
So I think in all ways we all have to do the
Can
work.
Can I answer the question Irene answered before? Is as combative as you're being on this, Irene, you answered the question 10 minutes ago.
Absolutely.
The same poll from the New York Times, Marjorie, that mm-hmm. you and I quoted 5,000 times 10 years ago. There were two demographics who supported gay marriage, only two. One were 18 to 29-year-olds. And what was the second demographic? People who said they knew a gay person.
Oh, yeah.
And it's what Irene said before. When you get to know transgender people and they're not scary.
That's why I think Orange is the New Black, even though it's a small number of people that are obsessed with this. But it's a small number of young people that are obsessed with this television show. It's on Netflix.
Don't say anything, Irene.
Okay,
let's stay positive.
Okay.
I was afraid she was going to blow away the argument.
No,
let's leave it at that.
I do think even though this is a prison situation, we know that. It's about a woman that goes to jail. I still think it's having a very positive impact on the teenagers in the young 20s that are watching
Can
that
I
show.
Piggyback on that in a positive light?
You said. Okay, I'm sorry.
I so agree with you, Marjorie, just this moment. And the reason being, we have come a long way from when Rita Hester, who was killed 2 decades ago, this is why we have Trans Remembrance Day of Remembrance, who was killed here in Austin, and we have yet to find her assailant, who supposedly had this sort of gay panic defense as reason why he just went crazy. We've come a long way to absolutely where Rita had to move through the night and be a night crawler and couldn't be seen, to now having someone like a Laverne Cox on the cover of Times. And I just need to say another thing. And it's a good day in terms of LGBT movement, because as we were moving towards our, you know, own sort of moving towards mainstream society, the only images you saw in terms of gayness were white, which gave the black community that it was a white disease. So
yes,
the fact
that's true.
That we see now a transgendered woman here is just wonderful, particularly since the largest population of homelessness is very much African-American transgendered.
Okay.
How about that being positive?
Now, since I was
positive.
So positive, let me bring you both down then, because that was too positive for Irene Monroe.
Okay.
When I read this statistic this morning, Marjorie and I were looking at each other. This can't be real,
stunned.
But it is. 56% of recent black college graduates are in a job that does not require a college degree. 56%. So what do you say to a black kid who's contemplating going to Northeastern, where you are, Emmett Price, and says, it's a lot of money. I'm getting a little bit of dough from the school. I have a loan. But wait a second. I'm going to do this. I'm going to spend 4 years of my life. My parents and I are going to have $100,000 in debt at the end of 4 years. And the odds are that I'm going to be doing a job that I didn't need to spend this money. What do you say to that kid?
I mean, the first conversation, let me understand why you want to come here, right? Let's have a vision for what our journey will be like. And then the second conversation, let's learn how to network now, right? Because you network yourself into the job. And part of the issue is we used to go to college in order to get a job. You know, now you go to college in order to network yourself into the job. And if you miss that lesson, then you're out in the lines like everybody else competing with graduates from the last 3 or 4 years trying to get that job. I mean,
so is that happening? I mean, is that talk or is that walk?
Well, it's talk. I mean, you know, for the number of students who get it, they end up walking into a job. The problem is that we still have the phenomenon of wanting to be a college student, and we'll worry about the job after we graduate.
But you know,
and by
you,
then, it's too late.
But you have a different kind of curriculum that a lot of students, whether they're black or white, just by going to Northeastern, are likely to get a job. But one of the things it reminded me of is this saying that when white America has a cold, we get pneumonia, just showing the disparity here. But I think we also need to sort of change our view about what college is about, this whole notion of we go to college to get a job versus getting an education. So I think that if we do a shift around that. But the interesting
but shouldn't
thing
we,
is...
shouldn't we do both? I mean,
exactly.
It'd be nice
yeah.
if
exactly.
it turns out we were educated and prepared yeah. to be able to support ourselves yeah. and ultimately a family,
well, I think
right?
That would be nice, but we need to talk about those that are in Congress and the bankers. Or, I mean, the economy. I mean, that has a lot to do with it because it depresses me to see students that I have tutored and taught at Harvard serving me now Starbucks in Cambridge. So, you know, it's across the board. These are just false promises, you know, of higher education today.
Well, I mean, part of the issue is societally, you know, the success of graduating from high school is going to college. And so we get into college and then there is no next step. I mean, we kind of fight, you know, 17, 18, 19 years of our life just to get into college. And then, you know, assuming that once you get there, everything will work out for itself. And it clearly doesn't. Now, the flip side is there's a lot of, you know, racial privilege going on. There's a lot of, you know, some of these situations where you have the extension of white privilege is that, you know, you have networks of opportunity and individuals who, whether uncles, aunts, family members, who are looking out for right. you. So you have to get the degree so that you can come work for the family business.
I know.
And, you know, African Americans and Latino Americans have a disproportionate of opportunities when it comes to situations
well,
like that.
Well, you know what? A college degree started to be devalued once they started. And people, and it's true, affirmative action. Because you could get a degree. And it goes nowhere. And we've seen this for decades here. And so then we decided, well, then the people who would only go somewhere, those who go to the top tier schools. And given the economy the way it is, they too now don't have access to jobs. But it says something that a law student, you know, graduates from Harvard Law School and becomes, you know, a paralegal.
Well, let's talk about someone who didn't graduate from Harvard
school.
Law School.
No, she did not. That would be Maya Angelou,
who
died several days ago. And there was a beautiful memorial service for her at Wake Forest University over the weekend where Michelle Obama spoke. Let's hear a little bit from Michelle Obama.
She touched me. She touched all of you. She touched people all across the globe, including a young white woman from Kansas, who named her daughter after Maya and raised her son to be the first black president of the United States.
You know, I should have said she was 86 years old when she died, and if people don't know, she wrote a million things, autobiographies. Why the Cage Bird Sing was one of them, and the story of her childhood. My favorite story, the most harrowing story, is her father putting her at age 3 and her 4-year-old brother on a train alone to go cross country to a relative with her little tickets pinned inside their jacket. But she had a phenomenal life. I would imagine Irene Monroe, she had an impact on you growing up.
Absolutely, I read all of her.
Did you?
Yes, I did, because it's the only genre, the biography and the memoir, it has always been the genre in which it's been a talking book for black women. And in all of those books, she's saying repeatedly, black women's lives are sacred texts. And given the assaults of racism, sexism that we have felt across the centuries, she says this, that no matter what society says, we are phenomenal women, and given the strength, collectively and individually, no matter what the lies are, still we will rise. So, you know, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know what I also thought that was fascinating about her, too, is that, you know, there was always, I mean, she was 86,
mm-hmm. yeah.
so she certainly grew up in the good girl versus bad girl thing.
That's right.
And she let it all hang out in a way, black or white. You know, a woman of that era would not talk about being a prostitute, mm-hmm. and being a prostitute for lesbian, all these things she admitted, which I thought were incredibly courageous.
I mean, you think about the company that she kept, though, and the various numerous individuals. I mean, a confidant of Dr. King, you know, a confidant of Malcolm X. I mean, someone who dropped out of high school at 16 and became a streetcar operator in
That's
San
right.
Francisco, the first African-American woman to do that.
And also be a madam now, yep, and prostitute. And,
And then a street worker, right, to turn around and to try to bring healing to the young women who are out there working, and then to travel the world, right, and to become confidant of heads of state. I mean, I thought, President Bill Clinton's comments were phenomenal, as were her son, right, Guy Johnson, because we always forget, you know, that you have, Oprah Winfrey and Cicely Tyson and the, you know, the surrogate family, but she did have this son, Guy Johnson, and to hear him speak and to have a same tonality of voice that she did and the
same kind of phrasing
that she, I mean, it was so awesome, you know, to hear him pay homage to his mother and then to thank the world for really receiving her and to share the dynamic influence and impact not only that she had on them, but that they had on their family of always receiving them as well.
I think the wonderful thing that Bill Clinton said, he says that he was talking about her books, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Yep. And he says, and he talks about the time that she was sexually assaulted, and she didn't speak for 5 years. And he says the ironic thing is that she is one of the most noted and important and greatest voices in the planet. And it was like, absolutely.
Speaking of one of the greatest voices, as we say thank you to Reverend Emmett Price and Irene Monroe, we're going to treat them and you to her voice. Here she is, Maya Angelou, introducing her poem, Still I Rise.
Everyone in the world has gone to bed one night or another with fear or pain or loss or disappointment. And yet each of us has awakened, arisen, somehow made our ablution, seen other human beings, and said, morning, how are you? Fine, thanks, and you? It's amazing. Wherever that abides in the human being, there is the nobleness of the human spirit.
It's the voice of Maya Angelou reading her great, talking about her great poem, Still I Rise. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at the Huffington Post and Bay Windows. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black
Church.
Well,
I'm going to rise
and
be phenomenal today.
Hip-hop culture toward bridging the generational divide. Up next, we're going to ask you, when it comes to hotel lodging, are you willing to give up your corner suite and king-size bed for a teeny tiny cabin? Is micro-lodging the future of travel? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
By the rude bridge that arched the flood.
Two thieves broke into the Gardner Museum early
Summer. Probably the first big event Copley Square, since the tragedy, we were extraordinarily proud.
Boston, the last 63 years. It's a flash drive packed with iconic stories from the last six decades. Help keep our city and our region better connected by supporting WGBH with a gift of $64. And to say thanks, we'll send you one. Reserve yours at WGBHnews.org.
Support for WGBH comes from you. And Triumph Modular, offering leased and permanent modular buildings. Triumph Modular's manufactured buildings are used for schools and commercial use, including office space, healthcare, and more. Triumph, redefining modular. TriumphModular.com. And Olin College of Engineering, collaborating with educators across the globe to revolutionize engineering education and spur the next generation of innovation. More information available at olin.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And when you travel, is it worth it to you to spend big money so you can have, I don't know, a big room, big bed, a space where you can really sprawl out? Or do you prefer to save money by saving space? Micro-lodging, as it's called, is the latest trend in travel. In Amsterdam, there are hotels where you can rent a 75-square-foot pod for minimal money. Think about that, 75 square feet. In Boston, a developer is aiming to bring similar space savers to the Seaport District by way of Yotel. It's a hotel chain where the rooms are small and cheap. And one downside, obviously, is they may even be too tiny to house a mini bar. The number is 877-301-8970. So does micro-lodging appeal to you? Would you do it? You save a ton of dough. Does the idea of being in a tiny space seem liberating, or does it take the fun out of travel for you? Again, 877-301-8970. It's coming to the Seaport District. I just read this morning San Francisco is about to get one as well. It is the low-cost, small space alternative to wildly expensive hotels. And I have to say, even though I'm a fairly large person, I love it. I think it is a brilliant idea. Not like they have in Japan, where literally that you have a drawer. I mean, you literally, they put you in a drawer and you pay whatever you
imagine
pay for.
Trying to close the drawer.
But what's wrong? I mean, when you go, when you.
Nothing. I think
when you do
is,
the, also, when you,
you're
you're
in
New York.
You're never in the hotel room.
Exactly.
Anyway.
You're not in the hotel at all.
Not in the hotel room anyway. So I think this is a great idea. They talk about this, the one in Times Square, where you can spend $240 a night for this Times Square location compared to $374 at the city's downtown Marriott. So that's a big deal.
It's huge.
That's
like 50% more.
Yeah. So what? I mean, they're cute little rooms. I mean, you just squish right in there. And who cares about the mini bar? The mini bars are overpriced anyway. You don't want to take out of the mini bar when you're staying in hotels. So I think this is a great idea. The only thing I don't think is a great idea, and this Boston Magazine piece raised a great point, in the Innovation District, you know, it's a long haul from the Innovation District or the Southport District down to, you know, the great parts of Boston you want to walk around in. I mean, I know we've got the Convention Center, we've got the Legal Seafoods, and we got a lot of good restaurants down there in the Southport District. But I don't know if it's, you know, the idea of the Yotel is in a place like Times Square, it's got a lot happening, or Midtown Manhattan, as opposed to kind of being out in the end of South Boston.
Don't be a nattering nabob of negativity or whatever Spyro Agnew said. Yeah,
I think
that's a good
this could
point.
Help the obesity problem right. in America, too. You know, you get little hotel rooms, little people.
Well, the other thing is you have to sleep standing up. That's a 877-301-8970. Are you ready for a Yotel? Let's assume you're traveling, or if you're listening and you're about to come into Boston for a weekend, would you stay in a Yotel? It will be in the Innovation District, at least this first one, if it's built. But I'm assuming if this catches on, and can you imagine it not catching on? I mean, don't you limit your travel to places that you otherwise would go for a weekend because of the absolutely scandalous hotels?
The,
and what you
price,
said is perfect.
The price of
you
the
know
hotel
you're going to be
rooms.
There. You're going to sleep, so you don't even pay attention to what the room is like. As long as it's clean and it has the whatever basic amenities. And you know what the beauty of this is, which I also love? You know, when you go to buy a phone these days and you say to yourself, I assume you're like me in this regard, I want the simplest Droid or the simplest iPhone you have. Well, you get these 4,000. This is the same with a hotel room. I don't want all that crap.
Yeah.
I want a hotel room that is clean, is attractive, is safe, and I want to then be able to go enjoy the city or the place where I am. That's what this is. It's essentially a stripped-down version and a small stripped-down version of a traditional hotel. I think it's a terrific idea.
Well, you know what else? If you've ever been on a cruise, I don't think you have been on a cruise, have you?
Nor will I ever
be. Well, the rooms are really small on a cruise. I mean, the bathrooms are ridiculous on cruises. That's the one thing. You can hardly turn around in the shower. But if you've survived for 3 or 4 or 5 or even a week on a cruise, this is nothing. I mean, those are little teeny tiny bedrooms. And you know, nobody takes trains anymore, but I've been on one of those overnight trains that were tiny. It was great. I mean,
you mean like the place where you sleep thing? On a train?
Yeah.
I've always wanted to do that, by the way.
It's really neat. And you
great.
Know what? When you do it in England, going into Scotland, they wake you up in the morning, they come into your room with breakfast in bed. They have coffee and little pastries, and it's absolutely wonderful. Or maybe it was tea. It was one of those things.
In a Yotel, you can't have breakfast in bed because it doesn't fit. 877-301-8970. Yotel is coming. Apparently needs some approvals. But the assumption is it's going to happen as it's come to other major American and international cities. Are you on board? Let's start in Brookline, the hometown of Marjorie Egan. Eric, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. Nice to talk to you.
You
nice
too.
Nice to talk to you.
I travel all over the world. I have stayed at the hotel in New York. It's fabulous. I love a well-designed small hotel room.
And what does it have? Eric, what does it have and what does it not have that a traditional hotel, other than space, what's it missing?
Well, it's not missing much. It's missing a big desk, if you like that.
Mm-hmm.
The bed is a sort of futon that motors up into a sofa and then comes down into a flat surface to sleep on, but it's really comfortable. And the one in New York has the largest outdoor rooftop hotel bar in New York City. So you have plenty of places to go.
The 11th floor hotel bar, that's supposed to be fantastic. What a great view, too, right?
So, Eric, as you're hanging out in the rooftop bar or you're in the lobby, are most people as upbeat about Yotel as you were in the city when you were there?
I haven't seen many unhappy people. I think you kind of know what you're getting when you sign up for it. You know, I don't think you go there if you're expecting the Four Seasons.
Yeah, I love the idea. Eric, thanks for sharing your experience. We appreciate it.
Well, Mary Beth hated it.
Why? Where'd she go?
She emailed. She said she was in New York for fun, won a contest. The room was way too small. The bed was made of rock. The shower was open. The bathroom area never got hot, so it was like taking a cold shower. Might be okay for business, just not going to sleep and going to sleep, but otherwise you're there taking a cold shower.
So she's undecided. 877-301-8970. Yotel. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. I assume it's Yotel if it's spelled like hotel, but with a Y. Yotel is coming to the Innovation District, apparently, in Boston. And are you on board? What?
Don't say.
What's it?
Why is it Yotel?
That's a very good question. Can someone, one of our colleagues, tell us why it
we
is Yotel?
We should have found that out, Jim.
I know, it's a little late for that, isn't it? But that's why we have colleagues, Marjorie, to rescue us from our own ignorance.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
Let's go to
Andy from Providence. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Andy.
How's it going? Thanks for taking me.
Excellent.
Thank you for calling.
Look, I'm 6'3", and I think it's a great idea. You know, why not some diversity in our hotel market?
And you save money.
And you save money. You know, if the city is interesting enough, which Boston is, then you're not going to spend much time in your hotel room anyway. We have micro living lofts in downtown Providence, and you know if the city's happening, why spend it in your hotel room?
Wait a second. Tell us about what's going on in Providence. You mean apartment living? Is that what you're describing?
Apartment living. Yeah, it's called micro loft living, and they've just converted the arcade, which is America's oldest indoor shopping mall, in right downtown Providence, and they have substituted some of the original storefronts with micro-loft living.
Wow.
Those are about two studio and one and maybe two-bedroom spaces. It's kind of extended stay, if you will, for people who are maybe traveling, or maybe they work in one city and travel to another, but it's something that's really popular and it's happening in Europe and now in the U.S., and we have that in downtown Providence. And so something like the Yotel, even though it's a shorter period accommodations, you know, they have it in New York, like you guys were mentioning. Why not?
That's a very healthy attitude, Andy, and thanks for alerting. I didn't know about the Providence, Rhode Island deal. Did you, Marjorie, as a former resident of Providence?
No, I did not.
You
know, I did not know that at all.
I love
pretty that. Neat to me.
By the way, I told you the favorite apartment I ever lived in, I lived in New York in a whole succession of illegal rent-controlled apartments.
On Giselle Bundchen's old street.
Well, she didn't live there yet, but it's true, on Barrow Street
she
in Greenwich Village.
For her.
I was in a one, she was about two then, I think. No, actually, she probably wasn't even born yet. I lived in this tiny studio apartment, and they don't call, well, whatever. I mean, whatever they call
can
it.
You imagine
a one-room apartment.
If you lived across the street from Giselle Bundchen when she was 19, how could you get anything done? You spend your whole time at the
window. How's Tom Brady get anything done? That's why you had an off-season.
Well, you know, I mean, that's a sort of a water seeks water kind of deal. You know what I mean?
But I'm telling you, the story I was trying to tell before Marjorie, of course, got off on a Giselle Bundchen tangent, which
I can't help myself,
is that when I lived on Barrow Street in the Village in an illegal rent-controlled apartment, which is the only way you can ever afford an apartment in New York City, it was a one-room apartment where everything was there. I mean, the bathroom is off, but the kitchen is like built into the wall, and it's essentially a Yotel kind of, or a Providence, Rhode Island thing. Like, what was his name? Andy just described.
Jeff on the road. What do you think about these teeny tiny hotels, Yotels?
Hey, Jeff.
Your name.
I think it's great because I want smaller, no frills, everything. You remember years ago when you went on an airplane ride, you got a four-course meal, you know, chicken, steak. Now you get a pack of peanuts, right?
I liked it better with the chicken and the steak.
No. When I go on a plane ride, if I'm at a restaurant, I go to the restaurant. I want a plane ride. You know, sweet, short, small, quick accommodations, in and out, bada boom, bada bing.
You know, Jeff, I don't know if you're old enough for this. Were you around when People Express existed?
Absolutely, yes.
People Express, for those who don't know, was the, I don't know how long it lasted, maybe 5 years, was a low-cost airline, I think mostly on the East Coast, a one-way ticket to New York City, if you traveled at the appropriate time, which was a lot of the time, $19 each way. You got to pay for everything. You know what they call, they created a verb that never existed before?
What?
They used the word beverage as a verb. We'll be around to beverage you. I remember it was like, and this is totally true, Jeff. Every time, I used to take it all the time because I used to commute back and forth from New York City 20 years ago, whenever it was. 25 years ago, every single time People Express plane landed, what do you think the passengers did, Jeff? You still there?
No, I'm still here. They cheered.
They cheered, exactly.
Cheered.
There was a round of applause and cheers.
They were so relieved.
Because they got there, exactly.
That's not a
Jeff,
good sign,
thanks
Jim.
For the call. Well, maybe, who cares? Let's go. Jeff, thanks for the call.
Christopher from Boston. What do you think about Yotels, Christopher?
Hi, Christopher.
I have to say, I think it's a terrific idea. I love the concept. I remember reading like years ago about the equivalent concept in Japan, and this is going back like 10 years. And when I read it, I was like, that is an awesome idea. They should do that here. Now, having said that, I also spend a lot of time on ships, and we rent boats down in the Caribbean. And if you rent a nice catamaran in the Caribbean, your accommodations are very much like what this is describing. You've got a tiny little cabin, but you're very happy because you're in the place you want to be. But, I also think that this will open up tourism for younger people, people who are, you know, on a budget but really want to see Boston. Because, you know, compared to the cost of a $570 room right. at, you know, any one of our hotels, this could really open things up.
It's halfway between a hostel and a traditional expensive hotel. Christopher, thanks for the call. By the way, our colleagues, Chelsea, just told us that the family which owns or founded Yotel, you know what their family name is? Yo. So they decided, that's not a joke, by the way, and they decided, I don't think it's a joke, and they decided to combine the family name with hotel, and they created Yotel. The one caveat, we mentioned this before, but my understanding, I've not been in Japan. Oh, my apology. The parent company is Yo. It's I was close. In any case, you know, when he mentioned Japan, they have this in Japan. My understanding,
they put you in the drawers?
It's like a morgue, essentially. It's like a morgue for the living, is that you literally, you're like in a big drawer, is
yeah,
what I understand.
I don't think I'd like that, like being in an MRI machine all night long.
They put
I don't think
a tag
I'd like
on
that.
Your foot.
And... Yeah, I don't like that. The other hand, you go to these hotel rooms someplace, sometimes you're by yourself, and you walk in, and there's two big double beds, and you think, what am I doing in here? I should invite four people in to join me.
Well, you probably should. Maybe you have a good time.
Probably,
that's the whole point, Marjorie.
I probably shouldn't, actually. Okay, up next, maybe Bryan Cranston won a Tony last night, but does he go all the way in Godzilla? Jared Bowen joins us to talk about the latest on stage and screen. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
How not to win the World Cup.
It's very opposite to the other American sports because you have, let's say, 20, 25 players on a roster, and there's no coach in the world that has the right tone for every one of those 25. Doesn't exist.
Tips and tactics from Jurgen Klinsmann, coach of the U.S. national soccer team, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and Worcester Polytechnic Institute. NASA is coming to WPI on Saturday, June 14th from 10 to 4 for a free festival of science, technology, and robots called Touch Tomorrow. More at touchtomorrow.wpi.edu. And State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead. Proud to support Innovation Hub, Saturday at 10 a.m. and in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 9 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for a Tony Awards recap and to go over the latest movies and plays that hit Boston is WGBH's arts editor. That'd be Jared Bowen. Jared, as you know, is also the host of the TV show Open Studio. Hey there, Jared.
Hi there. Great to be with you.
And you?
Great to see you as always, Jared. So tell us, Jared, what did they do last night at the Tonys and were the big winners the people that should have won?
It was very generous last night, which I thought was fantastic. One of the reasons I love the Tony Awards is because it really is a celebration of community, which sounds, I know I sound like the rah-rah cheerleader.
Yes,
but,
you do.
You know, the theater community, I think, is it's not acknowledged as it often is or as it should be. It's not as polished as the Emmys or as the Oscars. And so you have people literally putting on a show. And that's what I love about these award shows. And it's not all about the celebrity, at least in the winners. They had a lot of celebrity on stage last night. One of the things that didn't work, I think, was Clint Eastwood trotting him out. I mean, he's starting to...
Did he have an empty chair with him again or
well,
no?
They
he's
actually did
old.
Acknowledge that in
no,
the, in
they
the
did
commercial.
Not.
They had him looking at an empty chair and somebody came
true?
Up and steered him away. It was pretty funny, actually.
That is, sounds pretty good.
But that's what I love about the Tonys is that it's this great sort of organic community feeling. And I thought they spread the wealth last night. There were no clear-cut winners even going into it. Can you guys not afford headphones on the show? They
no,
keep falling off my head today.
The broken ones for you.
Clint Eastwood was too old? Is that what you thought? He was looking
well,
too old?
He was a little doddering. I think
yeah.
there should have been a little bit more care for him. But the wealth was spread last night. No clear front runners. Sort of all across the board, including the musical winner was a show that started at Hartford Stage. So it came from way off Broadway.
The name of which
Manishwin,
was?
Gentleman's Guide to Murder, which unfortunately I have not seen yet, but it looked great.
Tell us about this Audra McDonald, because she won her sixth prize for acting.
She did for playing for Billie Holiday, and she this is a really triumphant story because you have to remember that Audra McDonald is only in her mid-40s, and already she has bested every other actor in theater history to win the most awards. Not only has she won the most awards, but she's also won them in every single acting category, supporting actors, main actors in a play, supporting and main for a musical as well. She's such a talent, and I had the pleasure of getting to know her a little bit when she was at the ART a couple years ago in Porgy and Bess, and she's so down to earth, and she's so funny and warm, and it's much, much deserved. Speaking of which, ART was a great story last night.
Yes.
All the way
should be their new slogan, because they have sent so many shows to Broadway at this point, Porgy and Bess, Pippin, Glass Menagerie, and All the Way, of course, which have gone on to win Tonys, including Glass Menagerie. They just won one technical award last night, but they're on a roll.
I have very good news for you, by the way. Our colleague Will has entered the studio. He's going to switch your headphones so you can stop complaining, Jared Bowen.
So I don't have to hold them up to my head anymore.
The ART was not robbed that they did not win more in Glass Menagerie, because I know people were a little disappointed locally about that.
Well, I'll be honest, and I thought that Glass Menagerie was the better show. So I think it is unfortunate that the show didn't win more.
Okay.
But that had one of the fun acting categories. You had Cherry Jones, the great theater actress, who played Amanda Wingfield in Glass Menagerie, up against Audra McDonald.
We had her with us a couple of years ago.
We did, when she was playing the nun in Doubt.
And she had just finished doing a thing on 24.
And she was
terrific. Had she not done something on 24?
She was so odd. President on 24. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny about her. She'll show you this line that she has on her neck, Cherry Jones will, because when she was playing Sister Aloysius in Doubt, she was wearing her habit and her, what do you call the thing on the head for nuns?
Go ahead, Marjorie.
I don't know.
Marjorie, that's why I'm looking at you.
I know,
exactly.
I can't
think of it.
I'm
looking
spacing
at you.
Too. But anyway, that piece, the habit.
Thank you, John.
There's a special name for the hat.
Whatever.
We'll look it up.
Whatever it is, it was so tight around her neck for the show that she actually had a line across her neck that stayed.
I think it's a wimple.
A wimple. That's exactly
it. That's it. Thank you, Chelsea.
It stayed.
Okay, so wait a second. So Bryan Cranston won Best Actor, correct?
Yes, for playing LBJ.
Okay, and the Best Musical Actor. You know, I have to say, I got to get over my Neil Patrick Harris thing. For some reason, I am not ready to acknowledge that he is the brilliant performer that he apparently is. So in that spirit, here's a little bit of him performing Sugar Daddy from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Here's Neil Patrick Harris. Okay, enough of him. Now, can you tell me, why am I the one outlier in America? All of America loves Neil Patrick Harris. What is my problem?
It's a huge problem. Did you not see him last night?
No, I didn't watch last night.
If you saw what he did just in that number alone last night, it was riveting. He's got everything. First of all, he's a charming person, and I think he set the bar so high in hosting the Tonys now that even Hugh Jackman couldn't measure up last night. So he's got the charming guy thing down. He's got the great personality. He's a terrific dancer. He's a great singer. He really can do it all. And he's somebody who has transcended so much, too. I mean, he came out as gay, of course, and still managed to play this Lothario character on How I Met Your Mother. He's just a whole lot of talent.
It's Doogie Howser disease. That's what I'm convinced. You know, it's sort of like if James Gandolfini was alive and try to do singing and dance, I don't think I could deal with it.
But
and
it's for Broadway. It's Broadway. I know that, Marjorie. What they do.
I'm not defending myself. I'm trying to explain my blockage, but I will try to get over
can
it.
Can you deal with seeing Hugh Jackman do these things?
I'm not a huge Hugh Jackman fan.
No.
I'm sorry. No. is there anything else we should know about from the Tonys that we missed or no?
No, I think we covered it.
Okay, fine. Let's talk about a couple of plays in town. Let's start with Smart People. What's the deal?
Smart People. This is a very provocative play, and it's a great story behind it, too. It's by Lydia Diamond, whose last play at the Huntington went on to Broadway. It was called Stick Fly. And this is a piece that she's been working on for about 7 years. And she started working on it before the Obama inauguration, the first election. And when there became this whole conversation and dialogue about being in a post-racial society, she, as a black woman, thought, well, I don't believe that we necessarily are in a post-racial society. So she wrote this play, Smart People, which finds four very educated, very intelligent, smart people. One is a psychologist, a tenured psychologist at Harvard. Another is a neuropsychologist. Another is an actor, and another is a surgeon. And the neuropsychologist discovers that there is a gene that makes people racist. And I should mention that while this is fiction, this is actually based on research that is happening right now, that is being explored. So what you have over the course of these 2 hours, and it's very funny too, by the way, is you have people with whom race is just at the surface, because you have a black man, a black woman, an Asian woman, and a white man. And race is just at the surface, as it probably is in society today. But of course, this is theater, so it's always bubbling over. And you see the confrontation that they each have when they realize that racism could actually be inherent in your DNA. It's a really fascinating piece. It's very well written, very engaging. It's one of those pieces that will make you think and think and think for days afterward.
Okay, let's move on to, and by the way, I don't get Neil Patrick Harris. I will someday. I do get Stephen Sondheim. So at least give me that. Into the Woods, what's the deal with that?
This is a great production. This is happening at the Lyric Stage Company. So popular that they've already extended it a couple times, and I think it now has to end on June 29th, but see it if you can. And Into the Woods is, it takes all those great fairy tales that we love, Robin Hood and Rapunzel and Cinderella, and the first act is telling their stories, which of course we know. We know how all of these stories end, and the second act is what happens ever after. And you see that what happens when Rapunzel doesn't have the confines of her tower anymore. What happens when she's out in the real world? That doesn't end up so well. What happens when Cinderella does end up with a prince who is Prince Charming for a reason, because he's charming to many people. So this is just, it's a terrific, you know, look at the fairy tales with a modern day sensibility. There's a housing crisis for the baker and his wife. You know, their apartment is way too small out there in the woods. There's a mass murder that happens in terms of Jack taking down the giant because he's a giant killer. It's mass murder. It's just, it's so fun. And it's Stephen Sondheim, so the writing and the music is so mathematical and challenging. And you have to be a very audacious theater company to put this on, because it's so difficult. And Lyric Stage Company does it so well under the direction of Spiro Voloudos.
I've always thought this is a very important play, because when you're reading those fairy tales as a kid, you think it's going to be happily ever after. And this just dashes your...
There's no happily ever after.
It's good to know at an early age, I always think. Okay, let's move on to another thing that's over at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, is The Tempest. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago.
With Teller, obviously. Teller was in the studio with us.
Penn and Teller, who does a lot of the magic. What was it like?
This is Teller, and I'm sure he probably told you guys this as well, realizing that if you look at The Tempest, it's about Prospero, who's this sorcerer-like man who's banished by his brother to an island, and he enchants the island enough so that he can bring the people, his brother and others who he wants to exact revenge upon, to the island. And Teller looked at this and thought, well, it's all magic. And so that's what the ART does here. So you have this magic by Teller, and it is riveting, I have to say. I'm not sure if either of you have seen it, but it brings you back. Speaking of being a child looking at fairy tales, you feel like you're a five-year-old sitting there in the ART theater thinking, how did they do that? This is incredible. I haven't seen something like this before. And then you have the dance by Palobolus, which is great, because you have the half-monster that lives, half-human, half-monster that lives on the island, and it's actually played by, his name is Caliban, he's played by two actors who are literally on each other's back the entire time, moving around the stage. I mean, it's got to be crippling at the end of the day. And you have Tom Waits doing the music. So you have all of these fantastic elements. I will say, at the moments where you don't have those different elements, it does slip and slide a little bit, and it can feel a little bit long. But really, when those musical moments, or especially the magic, happen, it really brings a show to the fore.
I'm a huge Tom Waits fan, as I told Teller when he was here a couple of weeks ago. Is this an original score, or is some of Waits' songs?
It's not. It's my understanding that's what they had wanted, but it didn't work out for various reasons. So basically, he opened up his whole catalog to them.
Well, he is you mentioned Monster a couple of minutes ago, and speaking of Bryan Cranston, which we also did a couple of minutes ago, what incarnation of Godzilla is this latest film? Do you have any idea? How many times has this been done?
It's 20-something, I think.
Is that true?
I believe so. I think when you go back and you add up all the different numbers all around the world, we're into the 20s.
Do we have a little sound from this is Godzilla the movie. We're moving from stage to screen. Here it is.
I want to talk to somebody in charge.
You are not fooling anybody when you say that what happened was a natural disaster.
You're lying.
It was not an earthquake. It wasn't a typhoon.
Because what's really happening is that you're hiding something out there. And it is going to send us back to the Stone Age.
Now, I don't like Neil Patrick Harris, but I can't wait to see this. How pathetic is that? By the way, let me just read the opening line of the review in The New Yorker, which is so great, by Anthony Lane. Wrinkled and crinkled, huge in Japan, heroically reluctant to give up, and forever touring the world on a mission to make us scream, Godzilla is the Mick Jagger of giant amphibians, which is a great line. Tell me this is great. But everybody I speak to says the first third is fabulous, the last third is fabulous, the middle lags. Is that where you are?
Okay, well, I know that you have yourself a big old man crush on Bryan Cranston.
Bigger than you can imagine.
I know that. And I'm so sorry to disappoint you.
He's a little thing in this?
But you could just hear from that trailer how, I mean, he's not great in this. What do you think? How is it possible that even he wasn't given great material to begin with? It's not a well-written show, but still Bryan Cranston doesn't manage to do much with it. And I agree. The only great parts of the film are the monster scenes.
How long does it take you to see the monster? It takes a while to build up to the monster.
It takes a long time. But it was a good narrative device to make you wait for the monster. And then they give you two other monsters who surface, who come out of this nuclear reactor before you actually see Godzilla, who, when he finally comes out of the... I guess it's a he. It's just
I was just going to say. Primordial
king is how they refer to him in the film. By the time he comes out of the water, you just want to cheer. And I think at the screening I was at, a lot of people actually did cheer. Except for the Japanese, who said that we've made him too bloated and we've made him American and he's overweight.
Are the Japanese really criticizing this version?
Did you hear that
conversation? Love this. No, yeah. I love
this. He has been eating, apparently, in his time off. It's been quite a while.
So does Bryan Cranston play the hero, or what is his role?
He plays, so there's a nuclear reaction that happens at the beginning of the film. He loses his wife, played by Juliette Binoche.
She's also great. Don't get upset.
It has a good cast.
It's a fictional thing, Marjorie. You don't have to worry. There's no Godzilla. She doesn't really die.
Remember The English Patient? It was all sappy, but she was wonderful in that.
So he spends the next...
Marjorie won an award years ago, by the way, for describing Tom Menino as the English Patient in one of her columns.
Right. Best quipster.
Best quipster of the year. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it was a great line. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think he spends about the next 10 years trying to convince, to the alienation of his family, trying to convince the world that there's something more happening. And he picks up these seismic readings, and that's how he knows Godzilla is about to come back.
Okay, so every teenager listening to the show wants to hear what you have to say about The Fault in Our Stars. Can we hear a little bit of The Fault in Our Stars before Jared weighs in, please?
One day I'm going to blow up, and I'm going to obliterate everything in my wake, and I don't want to hurt you.
You don't get to choose if you get hurt in this world, but you do have a say in who hurts you.
I am in love with you, Hazel Grace.
And I know that love is just a shout into the void and that oblivion is inevitable.
And I am in love with you.
All your efforts to keep me from you are going to fail.
We do without the sound there. Okay, so John, what's his name? John Green is a monster. He's huge. He wrote the novel on which this is based. How's the movie? Every teenager has read this book. How's the movie?
I loved it. I thought it was
really?
Terrific. I thought it was terrific. It's so unlikely. I mean, here you have these two teenagers who meet in a cancer support group and have this romance, but they have mortality hanging over their heads the entire time. And I just found it so sweet, and not that I've had cancer, fortunately experienced it very closely, but I find it very truthful in the way that they're very matter-of-fact about it, and they're even called on it. There's a whole passage in which the Shailene Woodley's character wants to meet an author who she's so riveted by. He lives in Amsterdam, and she wants answers to questions that she has lingering from his novel, and she goes to confront him, and he confronts her about using her cancer to get a leg up in the world and to get special treatment, because she's basically from a Make-A-Wish-type foundation is how she's able to go visit him. And I thought there was all these really great themes and conversations that were put into the story, but also told in this very practical way that isn't overwhelmingly melodramatic or saccharine. It just really, really resonated with me. And you have two very, very talented actors here playing these characters. And I should also mention that John Green based Hazel, the Shailene Woodley character, on a woman from a young girl, I should say, from Massachusetts.
Oh, really?
Who was only 16 when she died, and that was about 4 years ago.
Did you go to a media screening or with real people?
I went to a it was a real people screening.
And were you the oldest person in the theater?
No, it was a mix.
Really?
And that's why I think this is interesting, because it's such a great example for kids who need a sort of a good example about life and how to live rightly. But I think it's also a really good reminder for adults. You look back and you say, this is the person who I wanted to become, hopefully, if you're a good person, and it reacquaints you with some of those more idealistic notions.
Oh. We're talking to Jared Bone. We only have a minute left. I think Seth MacFarlane is one of the funniest people on the planet. People say this is one of the least funny films in the history of film. A Million Ways to Die in the West. Is that accurate?
It's a crashing travesty. I mean, this horrible. Is just horrible. And I love Ted. I'm a big fan of Family Guy. Seth MacFarlane he didn't know what he was doing in making this movie. It's wretched.
Can you explain to me? We only have 30 no. seconds left. I'm so glad. Well, I'm not glad because I love him. When you see something that is really horrible like this, everybody says it's really horrible, and you're in the business, don't you say to yourself, which I do, and I'm not in that part of the business, how did they let this go? How did someone as clever as him and the people he surrounds himself with not know that this was unfunny? How does that happen?
I do, especially in this case, because I think that Seth MacFarlane has such a facility for comedy, and he grasps it and he knows it. And how did he not realize
really?
When he was writing this, even, that this was just pat, that he wasn't advancing anything, he wasn't moving it forward, especially when you're entering into this canon where Mel Brooks and Blazing Saddles is the ultimate.
Man.
Oh, well. Poor Seth.
Poor Seth.
He was wretched. The whole thing is wretched. Okay, thank
Don't
you
worry,
very
Ted
much
part
for being
two
with
is
us.
Coming out soon.
Jared Bone is WGBH's arts editor. He's
Thanks,
also host
Jared.
Of Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 on Channel 2. Thanks, Jared. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School and Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, our engineer John Parker, and Devin Karambalis. And I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning.
Thanks for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow.